Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single book that I read as I read it. Or let me put it this way, every single science fiction or fantasy book. And today I'm taking the fantasy route. I'm going to be reviewing, or at least talking about, the follow-up book to The Way of Kings by Brandon Sanderson, and it is the Words of Radiance by Brandon Sanderson. It's the second book in the in a series called, let me just bring up the Wikipedia page here, Stormlight Archive. Wikipedia says, the Stormlight Archive epic fantasy series written by American author Brandon Sanderson. And it's a funny Wikipedia page because it's sort of like published by Tor Books. And then, you know, all the stuff is about Tor Books. And even when it comes down to here, it says, you know, I looked at this thing here, reception and sales. And one whole paragraph is like, another review published by Tor Books commented, The Words of Radiance is worth reading. The Journey, yes, you should buy this book. And I'm like, why is Wikipedia listing as reception and sales sort of like a review that was published by the publisher about the book? Anyway, this is not that kind of review. So the kind of review this is, though, is a bit tricky because you're thinking, well, okay, have you read the first book in The Way of Kings? No, a lot of people haven't. So maybe talking about the characters and go, oh, I like this character, they've done this and this. You don't know any of the characters and you don't know the world, but I don't want to go into too much about that because if you've not read that first book, or at least if you've not listened to my previous review of that book, which I think is episode number, I'm now just looking things up on my own website. Yes, 159, and this will be 259. So yes, it'll be about 100 episodes ago, I reviewed The Way of Kings, and I gave it 3.5 star rating, and I talked about it for a long time, because it was a massive book, you know, it's like 1,000 and something pages long. And it turns out this book is also about 1,000 and something pages long. Massive, massive chunky books. I listened to it as an audiobook. The previous one I read as a paper book. And I'm actually pretty glad that I listened to it as an audiobook, because I don't think I would have gotten through another 1,000 pages of this book if I'd have had to read it myself. But I'm on a work trip and I had a lot of time free. Well, not a lot of time. I made a lot of time to listen to this book. Went to the gym and went juggling and sat in a hot tub and went for walks and sat by the beach in Brazil, you know, in this work trip. And so I managed to get through a 48-hour audiobook, which I think is probably the longest audiobook that I've tackled. Maybe Stephen King's The Stand was longer. I'm not entirely sure, but I could probably look it up. But it was a big effort to get through this. So I made some notes as I went along because I don't want to talk too much about the story or about, you know, about the setup of the world. You can listen to my previous episode, although it's like 1.5 hours long. So I made some notes about things that I liked and disliked as I went through. However, it is a bit tricky because if I'm generally enjoying a book, and this book was generally enjoyable, I mean, it was, I think for me, it was definitely definitely worth reading. I enjoyed it. Okay, again, it's one of those things that if the next book comes out next year or in 2 years' time, will I go for like another 50 hours of listening or pick up a book and read it again? I'm not sure, because it seemed to have come to a nice conclusion, or like most of the storylines that I'm actually interested with these characters seems to have come to a pretty good conclusion. In fact, one of the storylines seemed to have come to a pretty good conclusion last book, and then it's kind of left over into this book. But I'll talk about that in a minute. But, you know, as I was making notes about things that I enjoy or didn't enjoy, generally it was things that I didn't enjoy that I was noting down, because unless a book is, like, really good or a scene is really good, I won't just, you know, because if I'm reading as an ebook, I can just, like, highlight a passage. And so I like that. It's really easy to do. But when I'm listening as an audiobook, I've got to get out the phone and open up the notebook and actually type some stuff out and pause it and things. And it's just a bit... Note-taking with an audiobook is a little bit more tricky, so generally I want to... I just put down things that I don't want to forget to talk about. But if I'm generally enjoying it, I don't want to be pausing it and stopping it. And so generally, things in this book were enjoyable. But let's get now onto things that I want to talk about. Go through some of my notes here. I've got notes on my computer that I just wrote up, and some notes on my iPhone as well, which I would have emailed to myself, but I don't have internet access right now, and forgot to do it before. Or put it this way, I'm on a cruise ship. And internet is really tricky because you've got to log in and it costs a lot of money and you have satellite internet and I can't log in with my phone and my laptop at the same time, just to email my self this. Okay, so so let's get into it. Oh yeah, world building. I really liked generally the world building. I talked about it a lot more in the podcast because I think that is one of Brandon Sanderson's strengths, that he can come up with like an interesting new place. And And I thought in the previous book, the world was quite interesting. And in this book, it is also interesting as well. There's these storms that come through and infuse the things with magic, these beads with magic or these shards with magic. And then they've got these big swords called shard blades and armor called... And it's very, you know, visual. It's like, kind of very movie-like. And then there's some images that went along with this book. And you can find... I looked on his website to see if I could find some of the images, like the illustrations that are printed in the paper book, and I found them, and they've got these, you know, it's very macho, you know, you've got these swords, and they're like, yeah, these massive swords, like, you know, oversized swords, like, I was watching the movie Edge of Tomorrow, or Live, Die, Repeat, or whatever it's called, with Tom Cruise, and they have in there, like, these big swords, which they can chop aliens in half with, and they look very anime, but of course, that original story was based not on a manga, but I think sort of like on a Japanese novel. So those big swords are probably directly from that. And it seems like these are the similar kind of things, like the anime manga kind of big sword battle things, but also mixed with lightsabers. Because the lightsabers, when you don't need a massive sword which can cut through anything, it kind of just packs away nicely, and they tuck them onto the belt. And then when they want them, they can just put out the hand and goes, and the force just sucks into the hand, and they turn it on. It's like whoosh, whoosh, like that kind of stuff. And that's what you have here, except that Sanderson has kind of done away with having to have a handle, but there is kind of a handle, but they can knock it out. And instead of using the force to bring it back to it, you kind of just open your hand, wait 10 heartbeats, and then the shard blade is back in the hand, you know. So there's a lot of fun stuff in that kind of thing, and there's lots of action, there's duels and battles, which are also really good fun. Again, I don't think I need to go more into that kind of stuff. Oh, the story. So the first book was quite interesting because it's such a chunky book. You're like, okay, what is going to be the structure of this? How are they going to tell, how is it going to tell a coherent story? And it started off and it was like, prologue. And they're like, okay, there's a prologue. And then prelude. And you're like, okay, so there's a prologue and a prelude. And then it goes chapter one. Oh no, part one. And you're like, okay, so there's preludes, parts, a prelude, a prologue, parts. And then in between the parts were like these interstitial, bits and pieces where they told stories from other points of view, and there's a bit of that going, the same kind of thing going on here. I can't remember if there was a prologue and a prelude to this book, but when I got to the end, it was like epilogue, and so there's this epilogue, and then this end note, and I'm like, whoa, so we had a prelude, a prologue, and now an epilogue and an end note. Thankfully, the end note was only one paragraph long, and then there's appendix. And then someone, one of the audiobook narrators, starts reading out a table. So she reads all the titles to the columns of the table, and then starts reading out the next line of going column by column. And I was like, this is almost impossible to understand. This is definitely something I'd have to look up. So I finished listening 14 minutes before the end of the last part of the audiobook. It came in six parts, each about 8 hours long. Pretty impressive. So yeah, the story picks up pretty much where the last one ended. And it felt like, at the start, it felt like there was more going on, because in the first one, it's like, okay, let's set up the world, let's have this info dumping, let's have this character moving from here to here to here, and they arrive there. And then at the end of the last book, another character, Shallon, she was like, well, she, in that book, she was like always doing her stuff by herself over in another place, and then she's like, and now I will go and meet up with these other people. And I thought at the beginning of this book, she would arrive, but she doesn't. It takes her quite a while, you know, probably about half the book or a quarter of the book, to get to the war camp. And the war camp was where all the interesting stuff was happening in the last book. There was these two characters, one called Kaladin and Dalinar. Kaladin was a slave who was trying to not die and trying to band his a group of slaves together to be good. And at the end, he saves the day. And no spoilers there, really. And then Dalinar was the king who was trying to be a good king, but, you know, the politics and fighting and blah, blah, blah. And it was that Kaladin, Dalinar... And what was the other character's name? Dalinar's son. And this is the thing that kind of annoys me a little bit about this book, is that lots of people have similar names. There's Dalinar, Adolin, Kaladin, Navani. These names, actually those names aren't so difficult to tell apart. But there's some names which are very difficult to tell apart. And generally, if someone's a bad person, their name begins with S. So there's Seth. And Sauron, it's not Sauron, but, you know, there's the other other names. And then there's Sabalel or something like that. So I'm just saying that sometimes they'll say a name, and I was like, I'm bad with names. And they'll say a name, and I'm like, I don't remember what that name, who that person is, until they talk about them in context. And if you could say, okay, that character over there who's a really memorable character, what is his name? And I'm like, A something Lin, Demlibdilimidin, and I just wouldn't even know. So thankfully, it doesn't get in the way too much of me enjoying the book, but some of the names are just a little bit too similar. And they're meant to be similar. It even says, oh yes, we want names which are kind of symmetrical, which sound symmetrical or look symmetrical. As you look at it, you're like, okay, that kind of works. But once everyone's name is symmetrical, it means that nobody has a name that stands out, at least not among the light eyes, which are the important folk, not the dark eyes who don't matter so much. Anyway, so what's next to my things? Story. Yeah, so it felt like the story had more going on, but I think it didn't. In some ways it did, in some ways it didn't. It felt like more stuff was happening, but a lot of the time people were kind of waiting around and for other people to catch up. And at one point it's like, okay, what I made a note here is sort of like, so if you're just thinking, okay, I want stuff to go on and people not to be waiting around, but at one point somebody they find glyphs or some not words but like numbers on the wall, like some letters and some numbers and this little message, and there was like a number counting down. They're like, oh, what is this? And then a few days later it happens again and there's some more numbers, and it's the same, the difference is the same number of days that have gone past, and it's like, oh, so this is a countdown. And you're like, okay, so it's a countdown to something that's happening in 60 days time. So you're like, okay, the climax of the book will be happening in 60 days time. So a few of the characters just seem to kind of wait around for a long time, for 60 days or however many days it is, and you're like, well, I know that nothing that important is going to happen until that point. And of course it does, and it builds up to a big battle at the end, because of course there's going to be a big battle at the end. This is epic fantasy. It has to end with a big battle, and the big battle is really good. I actually really enjoyed it, but it's like, well, it was a bit obvious that this was when it was all gonna go down, because there was a countdown, literally a countdown, like, well, this something important will happen here, so nothing up until that point will be as important as the thing that happens on that day. And it is very important, but it felt a bit like forced waiting instead of people just going, well, let's just do it now. It's like, well, let's wait until 62 days and then do it. Okay. Another thing I had a bit of a problem was, in the first book, the two main, or the main characters on the Shattered Plains, which is, I'm not going to explain it now, but that's the place where most of the important action happened in the first book, and in this book, that is the place. It's not so much a lot of epic fantasy is like a quest. We'll go from here to here, and when we get to the other place, but it's the journey that matters. Here it isn't. It's like, the action happens in this place. This is important. Let's do it right here. So the Shattered Plains, and all the characters there seem to have very clear motives. They were there to do something. They were there to achieve something. And it felt like they were actually moving along. In this book, sometimes I was thinking, well, what is that this character actually doing? They're kind of just waiting. And this other character, he had a very clear storyline in the first book. In this book now, he's the bodyguard of a king, and he is just kind of waiting and saving the king. So he's not doing anything. He is like, other people are trying to do something and he's trying to stop them, maybe. And there is, you know, it's a little bit more complex than that. But a lot of the times I was just thinking, okay, this character, who are they? What do they want? Where do they need to go to get it? And what do they need to do along the way to get it? And this was one of my main problems when I read the first Game of Thrones book, or the Game of Thrones, the first book in the Song of Ice and Fire by George R. R. Martin, was that there were so many characters. I was like, well, what does this character want? And they're like, well, they want to do that. Do they? Yeah. So why aren't they going and doing it? They are, but first they go over here, and then they walk backwards, and they kind of zigzag backwards and forwards across the country, and then go over here. And this other character, what does he want? Well, he wants to be honourable. It's like, well, it's gonna be stupid. And I felt like it was creeping in a little bit here. In the first book, I felt everyone was there to do something. And then there was this one character, like Shallon, and at one point I was like, now I need to list what I need to do. And I'm like, oh, okay, so what does she need to do? She had like five things. She needs to go here, she needs to find out this, she needs to get married over here, she needs to save the world, she needs to convince these other people of this. And I'm like, wow, Shallon has like a lot of motivation. She knows what she wants to do. And I was like, well, can I make that same kind of list for these other people over here? And I'm like, no, not really. I mean, in the abstract, but one of them is just continuing from the previous book. He still wants the same things. And I was like, well, didn't he achieve that last time? No, I guess he's got to go back. What else was a bit was interesting? Oh yeah, also a bit about prophecies. I don't like people being controlled by fate. It's like, and then you meet up with this person. It's like, why did you meet up with that? Well, fate wanted it, and then I went from there to there. And why did you survive? Well, it was fate wanted me to do this. And that sometimes feels a bit cheap to me. It feels a bit of like a get out of free jail free card when stuff happens for it's like, well, that was very fortunate, wasn't it? It was like, no, but fortune shines on me, and then it doesn't, and then it does. And you're like, well, what? Like, when do you get out of jail for free and when do you not? And then at some point, some god gives someone a message and then it turns out to be wrong, and then the god goes, well, I was giving you that message, but actually I didn't really mean it. I didn't want to give you that message, but I was told by this other bigger god that I had to do that and follow the rule. It's like, well, even the gods don't follow the rules of the gods, or they do, but then the gods, like, their rules that they put in place. And I was like, that just feels again a bit cheap, that like this prophecy comes and this will happen and it doesn't, and it's like, well, I didn't really want it to happen anyway. Like, well, God works in mysterious ways, and sometimes he works because the other gods told him to do it anyway. And that brings me to another point, which is sometimes characters feel a little bit too connected. And this is a real big problem with epic fantasy. I want epic fantasy to feel epic and big, that this is a massive world and that people can come and they can turn up. And over there in that other country, like, this whole other story is happening. That could be like a whole other series of books telling the stories of those other things over there. But when you've got like three main characters, or five, let's say five main characters, and all of those five main characters are connected to each other via the five other, like, secondary characters. And you think, well, those other secondary characters, each one of these characters has a secondary character. And then you realize, oh no, that secondary character is also a secondary character in this person's story, and in this person's story, and in this person's story. So, like, how many people are in this world? Like, there's only 10 people matter. Like, if there's, like, 10 main characters, and each of them have 30 connecting characters, like 30 other characters who influence them and do stuff with them. And then, I mean, of course, that'd be a bit unwieldy to read, but like, they can't all just be connected to the same people. Otherwise, the world feels too small. So those are some things story-wise which kind of annoyed me. However, that's some of those things are only small parts in it, this is a massive book, an epic book. So it's that didn't always get in the way. I'll get into what really annoyed me about the book later. Oh, things I did like. I really like the conspiracy theories and the factions, and that there's people think they're in control, but then these other people turn up and it's like, well, who are the Grey Skulls, and who are the Wind Order, and who are the Eagle Staffs, you know? And there's all these, like, conspiracy theories going on, like, really conspiracy theories, like, you know, at the time it's like, well, we thought this was the way to do it, and we're going to do this, and there's this religious order over here who wants to put their members in peril, and then they'll get magic, but do they or don't they? And these other people in here, do they have control of magic, or do they know about magic, or don't they? And, you know, this other, and all that kind of stuff. And it works really well in the kind of, like, the war camp politics and the politics between the nations. And it's like, and it's kind of comes out who Seth is working for and why all the leaders of these different countries and nations and empires are being killed. And there's some fun stuff there in the interludes about that too, which I thought was very well done. And also I liked that a lot of these are human conspiracies. It's actually humans going, okay, there's magic in the world and there's gods in the world, but we are driving the story. It's like, we humans are concerned and we humans want to do this stuff. Rather than in a lot of fantasy books, it's sort of like, and it's the gods who put things in motion. It's the gods. Of course, there is a bit of that in this, that the, you know, that there's big tremors in the sky and the gods are doing stuff and they're working on, and new magic is coming back to the world. But it's like, it felt quite a human book when it comes down to actually the politics and the conspiracy theories, which is good. There's battles in here and duels in here, which is also good. There's adventure stuff, also very exciting. The last quarter of the book, that was actually really good. You know, building up to the final battle and what happens there is actually quite satisfying. Even though there's no twists, I've come to expect some big twists from Brandon Sanderson, but there wasn't in this book. It was like, okay, we have, or if there were any twists, I could kind of see them coming far enough away. And then at the end of the book, which is, which, like, after all the battles and stuff, there was one other thing that kind of annoyed me a bit as well. And this character over here isn't dead. And I'm like, well, of course she's not dead, because all these other people who had her same powers can survive and not come back to life. But if they're injured, they're not finally dead. So what would that person be different? And you're like, well, why didn't, you know, why is it just said, and now this person turns up again? And you're like, that makes it too cheap. And of course, there has to be a revelation that this character is dead or not dead. Because it could just happen in the course of the story, but if it's suddenly like, and then she pulled back her hood and the person who came in to save the day was actually this person who you thought was dead, but actually she wasn't dead or he wasn't dead because of this. And you're like, well, that's a bit cheap. So then to bring them back so blatantly, like not in action and not in character, not in anything, sort of like a character is there, just hanging out, and they turn up and it's like, hello, hello, oh, you're not dead then. No, I'm not dead. Well, why aren't you dead? Well, it's obvious that I'm not dead. You know, that's not very dramatic. But then I was like, why can't we just like split the difference and have one of the characters, main characters, go, I thought he slash she had died. But maybe he slash she hadn't died because of this, that I know a bit more now. But then that is kind of like forcing the point home too much. So it's very difficult to like have someone come back who you think is dead and not come back, and not either have it not dramatic or not feel too cheap or cheating kind of stuff. And if that only happened with one character at the end of the book, I'd be like, okay, that's fine. But it happens to two different characters who come back to life at the end of the book. And I'm like, if it's too easy to bring characters back from the dead or characters who you think might have been dead, and then they come back, that it feels, yeah, you know, like if people don't stay dead, it means death doesn't matter so much. And death should have meaning in these books. So, yeah, and even then there's some other characters where I think, well, that character is probably dead. And then I'm thinking, well, do you see them actually die? Like, you know, it's that whole movie thing is like, do you see a bullet through their brain and their brains come out? In that case, yes, they're probably dead, unless zombies, and then they might not be dead. Oh no, zombies do die with brain splatter or whatever. Anyway, so it brings me to some of the characters here, and I enjoyed most of the characters except one character, but I'll get into that in the end. So there's Kaladin, who was one of my favorite characters, who has like the main story in this first book, and he has sort of characters around him. Kaladin was a slave, and he brought the bridge team together, Bridge Four, and it's like, yes, we are Bridge Four. And at the start of this book, he's like, we are Bridge Four, we got through that previous book and all the adventures, and we're still Bridge Four, let's do it. And I really enjoyed Bridge Four in the first book, but now all these characters seem to be put, like I said, into a holding pattern. It's like, now Bridge Four is a group of bodyguards, and they're going to go off and do bodyguarding stuff. So, well, beforehand they were really working for stuff, and it was really hard, and they were really pushing through stuff, and it was difficult because they were slaves in the midst of battle, and they were expendable, but somehow they managed to get together, and Kaladin brought them together, and it was like, yes. Now in this book, it just feel like, and now they're living in comfort, and they're going to get wives and stuff, because they're not slaves anymore, they're free men, and they can just kind of hang out. And you're like, well, that's good that they're hanging out, and they're all doing bits and pieces. They've all got small jobs, and they're all kind of heroic, you know, and they it's still a fun unit, and the characters are individually fun. But it felt like we were spending too much time with them, because really, that's not who the story is about anymore. It was the first book was, I'd say, about 50% Bridge Four's story and Kaladin's story, but now it doesn't feel like it's about them anymore. Kaladin is again in this holding pattern. He's just trying to work out his magic skills that he, you know, it was hinted in the last book that he had some magic, and then there's a Spren, which is like this little magic fairy kind of thing that he made friends with in the previous book, and it's a lot of him just kind of working out what his magic was, and that played out in a satisfying way. However, like, as a character, didn't really go on too much more. Same with Dalinar, who in the previous book was the king, and he was a troubled king, and he had these visions, and he thought he was going mad, but somehow he had to get together and unite all the things, and it's like, yeah, okay. And again, he kind of just does more of the same in this. And Aladdin, his son, does some dueling and has relationship issues, and his brother has a bit more of a, you know, complex story. I can't remember his name. And while their storylines were okay, that wasn't what the main part of this book was about. The main part of this book was Shallan. And Shallan is very problematic in numerous ways. First of all, in the first book, I actually recommended people, I think in my previous review, you listen back to episode 159, I said, just read the bits of, just read all the sections of the book, all the chapters or parts of the book, which are set there on the Shattered Plains, because that's where the main story was happening. That's where all the action was, that's where the conflict was, that's where the interest stuff was. And Shallan, in the last book, was very much in a holding pattern. It's like, she's in this situation, and she has to get this, she has to do this, you know, this con, this magic, there's this magic implement that she wants, and she's got to swap it, or whatever she wants to do. And you're like, okay, that's interesting, but really, she's just waiting around, and like, maybe 300 pages of that book were spent on her kind of mostly just waiting around and waiting for a chance and kind of getting into a relationship and getting out of a relationship and getting back into a relationship and with her, you know, with her tutor. And it's all about, you know, her learning stuff and growing up. And she was in the holding pattern. Now in this book, she's not in a holding pattern anymore. So it's sort of like, well, you need to have read all of the previous book to understand this, because this is now Shallan's story. So I can't just skip her chapters in this book, even though sometimes I wanted to, because to be honest, Shallan is, like I say, the main problem here. I made a note here on my laptop. Look at look at iPhone notes. So yeah, as I was going through, these aren't notes that I made at the end of the book when I finished it, but as I was reading through, I was like, Shallon is the worst person ever. She's completely heartless, almost evil. How can she drown a ship full of men and then just find a new group of men to boss around and discard? Which is a mild spoiler, but like at the start of this book, she's on this sea trip, and I was like, oh great, she's going to go here and she's going to get there. And there was some really terrible sort of like, foreshadowing. It was sort of like, oh, and there was this new man who came on the ship. Oh, there's a new man. Is that? Yes, here is a new man. Well, what's he doing here? Well, he's just a new man. I was like, well, he's an assassin. And it's like, the lock on my door isn't working. Why isn't the lock on your door working? Well, it doesn't matter. I'll just have to talk to the quartermaster or whoever it is to put a new lock on my door, fix the lock on my door. Oh, should you really? Cue to assassin getting through the lock on the door. And you're like, oh, really? And her way out of it is like, well, I might as well just, Shallon is like, well, I might as well just kill everyone. Like, I might not kill everyone, but if everyone just drowns, well, they were being killed anyway. Whereas this, in this way, I will kill the assassins and all the people the assassins were trying to kill, except myself. And you're like, really? That's the plan? It's just to kill everyone except yourself? And then she's saved in like a Noah kind of thing and taken over. And you're like, well, not Noah, in a Jonah and the whale kind of thing going on. And you're like, really? That's your solution, is just to go, well, I'll be okay, and everyone else can die. And then later on, she's like, and then she meets this other group of people, and I thought that first group of people on the ship, I thought they were going to become her bridge for, that she was going to learn leadership, and she was going to learn, you know, how to be strong, and how to bring a group of people together, and it doesn't happen. Then there's another group of people that she was like, oh, now I need to be more like this person, like more like my tutor who's got this strength. People do as she commands. They don't like her, but they respect her. Or maybe they like her and respect her, but the respect is stronger. I need to be more like that. And so she just becomes evil and annoying. And she's like, well, these other people, they're just dark eyes. I will just take over their lives, do what they want to me, do what they want to them, cause many of them to die, steal from them, but it's okay because I'm a light eyes and they're dark eyes, and light eyes are the aristocracy and they're the important ones and the dark eyes aren't, and I'll just do my own thing. And then she gets together with a new group of people. She was like, well, I'll just send most of these people to die. Why? Because, well, they're not going in my direction, and if they're not going in my direction, they might as well just die or die for me, and then I'll get together. And this group of people will be the people who get together, and these will be my bridge for. She's not thinking that, but she's like, this will be, and then she just kind of discards them, and then, oh, there was this other person she just discussed. And I'm like, what does human life matter to this person? And at one point she meets up with one of our other main characters, and she was just like putting on, she was like doing a con at the time. She was like, now give me your shoes. Why? Well, I'm light eyes and you're dark eyes, so just give me your shoes. And he's like, oh, really? And then he rides off, and she's like, I hope he'll be okay without his boots. And I'm just like, fuck you, this is awful. It's really, really terrible. And later on, to the book's credit, later on, it does kind of give some explanation. She does have a much better character. She has actual character development here. There is some stuff that goes on, but all the way through, I kept on thinking, like, am I meant to be liking this person? Or am I meant to be finding this person absolutely horrific and terrible and evil and spiteful and nasty? Because that's what she is. But all the time, and there is, like I say, there is some interesting backstory stuff. And in a way, I wish I'd have had that backstory stuff before, like in the previous book, because then I'd have actually liked Shallon better. Like, as a character, she is more, she's better developed in this book. But, like, she does start off as a place with someone who was really quite nasty, like, really nasty to anyone who isn't a light eyes like her. And for me, I found that very, very troubling, that I think I'm meant to like her all the time. She's really like making lots of jokes and everyone likes her, and she's set up in a relationship with one of the main characters, like this arranged wedding, and it's like, oh yes, I can't wait. And then she becomes like the Disney princess, as well as like the ass-kicking princess. She becomes the Disney princess and the clever one, and she's everything about her is meant to be good, and at the end she's a heroic and stuff. I was like, but she's still, she still just discards people. Like, at the end of the book, I was really worried that now she was like, well, we've got this whole army of 30,000 people, but this whole army is really just here to get me from A to B. And I'm like, she still doesn't get it, that everything about her is awful. Like, every way that she considers other people is so selfish, to the point of, literally, I'm going to endanger 30,000 other people just because they happen to be in the way of me, or not in the way of me, or what's going on here, all the way through the book. Very problematic. Which brings me to her sense of humour, which is one of the worst sense of humours ever. which is this is the formula for Brandon Sanderson quirky humor is I say something and then you say something, and then what I say again is I just take the literal meaning of what you said. You use a figure of speech, and I just give a response as though you didn't give a figure of speech, that what you said was literal and true, and that what you actually meant wasn't what you meant, or what you said was actually what you said, instead of just saying a figure of speech. And then I say that back to you, and they groan because you made what Brandon Sanderson calls a joke. So the perfect formula is like, you've got quite a tongue on you. Okay, now just in your head, if someone says, you've got quite a tongue on you, what would be the response to that? And she actually says, I've never had anyone's tongue on me. And you're like, okay, and then that's a joke. Oh, and they all fell around laughing. You really get into those drawings. Think about it. What would be the obvious response? Yes. No, I put others into my drawings. And then they actually, the response to that joke was, you've always got a quick answer. And I'm like, that is not just a quick answer. That is the perfect Brandon Sanderson joke formula. Later on, a robot explains, well, it's not a robot, but it's like, you know, like the companion robots in the drones, not drones, what do they call them in the culture? That one of those companion people. There's sufficiently analogous character. These little companions, these little sprites, these little what do you call it? Like a familiar or something like that. Sort of like. And now I will explain humor. What you do to make a joke is replace what is expected with something wildly unexpected. And you're like, okay, that could be what humor is. That is one sense. That is one way to do humor. However, if every single time we know the Brandon Sanderson female quirky joke formula, every time that person, someone says to her a figure of speech, we know that she is just going to take that figure of speech literally and say it back to her. So it is not wildly unexpected. In fact, it is wildly expected. And so what we do is just have this constant rubbish jokes, like really bad jokes, which aren't even jokes. It's just a single formula, like applied like a sledgehammer to the face with challenge. She just does this over and over and over and over and over and over again. Later on, we actually have a character just saying, why are you always joking all the time? Why are you doing this? You're really annoying. You're really annoying. Why are you so annoying? Everything that you'd say is really annoying. Stop being so annoying. Stop doing this. Stop being so annoying. Why are you really annoying all the time? And she, you know, there is some character motivation behind it, and it is slightly interesting. However, if the characters in the book realize that Shallan is that annoying, why does she have that? Why can they not, like, can't her annoyingness be explained in a way which we don't have to experience in real time for 48-hour audiobook, that same annoyingness? Because if it was just for that character being, like, better, if she is meant to be a morally and ethically and just spiritually a problematic character, can that not be reflected in her, in the way people see her, or in the way people like interact with her? There's this meeting between Shallan and Kaladin. These are the two main characters up until like the thousands and thousands and thousands of pages, and they meet each other. And I'm like, this is going to be an epic meeting. And in one of the, actually it happens twice. One of them, she's playing a character, so it's not like a real meeting between the two characters. And then they meet, and I made a note. It was the worst meeting of two main characters ever, because suddenly it's not a battle of will. It's not a battle of actual battle. It's not a battle of this person wants this thing and this person wants another thing, you know, and how are they going to do it? It suddenly becomes a battle of wits, and it's the same wits. It's just like, and now an insult back. And the other formula that Sanderson uses in insults, it's just like, and now, because these are high-born people, using, just saying the word poop, or saying, implying that someone smells or is messy, that is funny because they are highborn and they shouldn't be. And it's just like, oh, come on. And that brings me to the swearing in this book. I was going to talk about this in the writing section, but I went a lot into the swearing on what's wrong with the swearing in this book in my previous review. And what's wrong with the swearing is that a swear word has to be not a common word. If a word is a common word and then you use it as a swear word, it's not, if it's not forbidden in some way, so it has to be scatological, so it has to actually be shit, or it has to be sexual in some way, and like naughty, like fuck or cunt or something like that. Like, you even get offended just me saying that, because that's what it is. Or it can be religious, like, oh my God, or Jesus fucking Mary Christ shit in a box. You know, you can combine the spiritual, the religious, or the or whatever you could say, in, with the scatological and the sexual, and make some really interesting swear words just by putting them together, and you put them together in effective ways, and it works. However, like, if we live in the real world and there's tables everywhere, and you can't just go, oh, table. Table isn't a swear word. Wednesday, you know, Wednesday isn't a swear word. Whatever it is, you know, it has to be something forbidden. But in here, it's storm. And you're like, okay, storm. But there's storms all the time. And then people go, well, storm you. Oh, storms. Storm off you. And it's like, well, storming off is actually what someone can do if they're angry. They storm off. So telling people to fuck off, but then just replacing all swear words with storm just doesn't work. And in here, it's... I actually made a note that, like, if this book actually had swear words in the place of every time someone says storm as a curse, it would be the dirtiest, most, like, swearing book I've ever read. However, there is no creativity to the swearing. All of the characters use storm, and in this book, Stormfather, which I guess is a little bit more on point. Because that is actually a deity in a way. Stormfather is one of the storm gods. And it's like, oh, Stormfather. And it's like, but if you say Stormfather, do you expect bad things to happen to you? You know, that's why you say don't take his name in vain. It's like, well, there is no commandment in our books that you don't take Stormfather's name in vain, because we don't, that's not part of our religion, is it? I don't know. Anyway, so, yeah, Shallan says storm and Stormfather. Almost every single paragraph that we're in her head, it's like, storms, Stormfather, storms, Stormfather, storms, beads. No, beads is in the first chapter. So what other notes do I have here? This seems negative, but it is this one character. Unfortunately, this one character, we do spend a lot of time with her, and that is character development there. It is an interesting backstory. We get parts of her backstory come out, so it is worth reading, but you're just thinking, can we not just tone this down a little bit? Can this fantastic character, can her problematic nature be at least recognized, so we don't think that she's the amazing hero that everyone else seems to think she is, except Kaladin, but he's only annoyed with her because she took her... his boots, and it's like, oh, well, that's fine. Let's get on to some writing. Generally, it's competent, except for the humour and the swearing. It's very competent writing. There's some things which work out as well, though, going back to the swearing. It's like, he grabbed her by the torso. And I'm like, torso, is that what you grab someone by in a sexy move? Like, you're going to go and kiss her, so you grab her by the torso. Torso seems to be almost like a scientific name for somebody's body. Like, everything is very chaste. And every time someone does get to, like, truly swearing or saying a bad joke, someone will say, oh, and what you really mean is, what I'll do is, and they go, thank you. Someone says, thank you very much. Don't need to actually hear that bad writing or bad stuff. There's another, so actually, even when people do want to say something bawdy or sweary. Comedy stuff, I have read those notes. Oh yeah, also, if someone is called Wit, make them funny. Don't just use the Brandon Sanderson joke formula. Actually have them being doing and funny stuff. The dialogue generally is not very good, mainly because in almost every sentence, in every part, you could use quarter as many words as these characters actually say to each other, because they explain things to each other quite a lot, which is in a way good, but like there's some things which is just a little bit too repetitive. And like they will say, oh, actually, what I mean, however... actually, what I need to do is blah, 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 Noah, and I think you're thinking of this thing. And you say all those I think you're thinking of things. You don't really need to say all of that. Why don't you just say blah, 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 blah? Just say the word like Kaladin. And it's like, yes, I was thinking of Kaladin. Or yes, she was thinking of Kaladin. Instead, I think you're thinking about that bridge man from Bridge 4 who you called Bridge Boy, but is actually called Kaladin. It's like, well, you didn't need to say all that. Just say the word Kaladin. And that's what, all you need to do is convey meaning from you to the other person, and more importantly, from you to the reader. And we already know all those other stuff. So you don't need to actually explain it to each other. And I think that's one of the reasons why this book is so long, is that there's a lot of conversations in this book and a lot of things. It's just repetitive, which it's not repetitive always in a bad way, but you just think this book... couldn't, like, a lot of times when there's a long book, it's like, you'd have just chopped out down to 200 pages. And it's like, there's a lot too much stuff going on in this book. It wouldn't have actually got down from 1,000 pages to 200 pages, but it could have got from 1,000 pages down to about probably 800, 850 pages if just cut down on a lot of the dialogue. It just didn't need to be there. So much of the story works without it, but it did go on a bit too much. And then brings me to this final thing, which is kind of this a weird thing, which didn't get in the way too much. It was just a little bit jarring sometimes, where this weird mix of like old technology, or not even technology, but like oldie English, like generally like these fantasy books, they kind of go, okay, well, we're just going to do like medieval Britain or medieval Europe, you know, so it's lots of white people in castles with knights and peasants and just generally doing stuff like that. So it's not quite the Enlightenment yet, certainly not the Scientific Revolution or any of these other things. So let's just keep it around about, you know, 1300s, 1400s, where they've got the cool armor and they've got the nice castles and they can ride around on horses, but not too much other stuff. But then there's lots of these kind of words that seem to come from the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution and the Industrial Revolution. It's like, oh, and they use gravity. And I was like, when was gravity invented? And then this is made out of aluminium. And you're like, or aluminum, as it's, because it's an American book. And I was like, aluminum? Really? They suddenly have aluminum? I guess there was aluminum oxide, but they need electricity. And it's like, but aluminum is really expensive because, and I was thinking, it has to. You have to use electricity to make it. It's like, you have to use magic to make it. And you're like, oh, really? It's going to come down to magic? And you're just going to replace that. And yes, this person, this is a small ecosystem with apex predators. And you're like, small ecosystem with apex predators. And I was like, that sounds like super modern, like really, really modern. Small ecosystem with apex. And there's a lot of these other words. Like at one point, someone is sort of like, she just hit her teens 15 months ago. And you're like, hit her teens 15 months ago. Like the whole idea of someone hitting their teens and being a teenager, it's like super modern. It's like the 50s and 60s where teen culture became a thing. And even like the being in your teens was something. Before then, it was just an age. Like you were still at school. And then at 14, you went to work. So being in your teens wasn't a thing. There wasn't the disaffected youth. You know, being a grumpy teenager just wasn't something that you were, because you were just already at work then. You know, and if you weren't already at work, then you were being married off. You were meant to be, you know, you would come up to your coming out ceremony at 16. You know, it wasn't something, oh, you're still a moany teenager. And then at one point, Shalane is saying, oh, that's very sexist or very misogynistic. And I'm like, okay, so you're using like sexism and misogyny like as a thing? Like, though, if feminism has come to the point where misogyny is just a word that you use in everyday world and make jokes about and expect other people to get those jokes. Like, where does this language come from? And if it was just language, that's fine, because I don't want to read old English. Yes, thou sayeth to thine horse, you know, all that kind of stuff. I don't want that oldie language, but like the mindset has to the words has to reflect the mindset. And that comes down to one of the things that my notes about magic. It seems to be flowing, this review, from one note to another. Didn't mean it to do it this way. But what I like is that the magic, which feels magical in this, magic feels very technical. Like, I want the magic to be there for the purpose of story and character. And that's really interesting. That works really well in this book. I want this the magic to be spectacular. And magic is spectacular. I want it to feel magical. However, it's too technological, you know. It's explained so well that, you know, I think any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, which is Clark's first law or second law of science fiction or whatever it is. But I think there should be a Brandon Sanderson thing, like a spin on that, I guess, which is any sufficiently explained magic is indistinguishable from technology. And that's what we have here. It's like people doing science on magic and then using those outcomes. So what I liked about some like parts of this, it's sort of like in this moment, like at one moment, one character is threatened and then they just shoot out the hand and a shard blade comes out that they didn't even know it had and it shot through them and they saved the day. And I'm like, that felt magic. That felt someone in the moment for the purpose of character, for the purpose of story, for the purpose of action, for the purpose of moving the story forward. They discover something and are surprised by it and we're surprised by it and it feels magical. That's great. But so much of this book, and another reason why this book feels really long, is that these characters, they find out. It's like, oh, okay, that I have this hint of this magic. I read in a book that this magic is possible. Now I will go out by myself into this room or into this tent, or into this plane, and I are now going to investigate magic. And that's what they do. And then we have like a long section of them investigating magic. And does it work like this? No. Does it work like that? Yes. If I draw this picture, will it work? Yes. If I do this, if I turn my hand in this way, will it work? Yes. If I do this binding over here, will it work? No. Over here? No. Over here? Yes. Over here? And it's like, why is all this trial and error? Why is all this working stuff out? Why is it happening? Like in a sterile situation. And in so, like I say, some parts of the book, about half the time when someone discovers new magic, it happens, like I say, in the action, in the moment, and it feels good. About half the time it happens in this clinical environment where what their purpose is to, now we will do this and explain this magic to the reader. And then later on, when they use this magic, it will become, it won't seem bad. But like, at the end, one of the characters fights Zeth, and we met Zeth at the very start of the very first book, and Zeth is an assassin, and he jumps through a wall and comes down from the ceiling, and then runs up the wall and runs across the ceiling and flies down this way and sticks this person to the ceiling, and like, this feels amazing, like, what is going on here? It felt great that he could just stick people to the ceiling and run over the ceiling and change gravity in that way. By the end of this book, it doesn't feel magical anymore because we've been taken through step by step by this other character who has discovered those same secrets. And then at the end, it's like, now I will fight this person over here, will you? Well, yes, because that's what we are counting down to for 60 days. Let's do it. And they have a fight. And actually, they have two fights, or three fights. But the first fight felt that same kind of the magic that I wanted. Like, he was thrown into this situation. He was up against this person. He wasn't quite sure what his powers were. He wasn't sure what he was doing, but he knew. And suddenly he experienced it. I was like, that felt really great. Why can't he always, like, he has to be in action to hone his skills? Why can he just go out and use it when there's no danger and there's nothing, if anything goes wrong, it doesn't matter? Like, and Shallan's, when, as she is working out some of her new magic, felt a lot better because she's actually like, oh, I'm in this situation. I have to get out of this situation. I need to do it quick. Will this work? Will this work? When this will this magic work? Yes, it does. And people die because of it, but it doesn't matter because they were dark eyes. And will this magic work? Yeah, well, all of those people over there, they're going to die, but at least, you know, I'm out of here. Okay. So I say, it's this mix of like over-explaining and over-describing people learning this magic. What else was I going to say about the magic? I'm not sure. But yes, I think that plays back into the worldview of the author and the characters. It's too modern. Like, the way that they deal with magic is too modern. The way that they deal with life in general feels very modern. And yet at the same time, this brings me perfectly onto my final set of notes about the themes of the book. It's really, to me, politically regressive and problematic. Like, for example, there's this whole thing, it's like, there's light eyes and dark eyes. And I'm like, is this like a racial analogy? So there's white people who are important and black people who aren't important. But, you know, that would be too obvious if it was black people can't be landowners and white people can. That feels like really racist. But just imagine if that is the analogy, that at the end, which is what happens with a lot of these books, is like, and now everyone who helped me succeed gets rewards, and you get a title over there, and you get some land over there, and you become my prime minister, and you become that. It doesn't really happen so much in this book, but the analogy is that at the end, it's sort of like, and you over there who were a dark eyes, now you're a light eyes. So it's sort of like, and yes, because you became a good black person and were a helpful black person, now you become white, and you get all of the social benefits of being white. And I'm like, this is really weird, because all the way through, Kaladin is like, I hate the light eyes. They took everything away, and everyone should be equal, and these people over here should be equal, and the only light eyes who are worth saving are the people who think we dark eyes are the same as them, and that everyone should be equal, and it shouldn't be like the aristocracy is one race and we're another race like that. And at the end, he's like, and now you have light eyes. And I wanted him to do everything possible through the book never to get light eyes, never to be rewarded by light eyes. And he is that most of the way through the book. And then at the end of the book, it's just like kind of flipped around. It's like, oh, no, he's fine with it. Oh, I don't need. And I really wanted some of the light eyes to go, oh, actually, you know, I want a relationship with someone, and I'm going to have a relationship with the dark eyes. Why? Because it should just be the okay thing to do. But that doesn't happen. And the only person who that does happen to is like seen as this kind of like outcast kind of guy who shouldn't really be worth it. And then that relationship isn't presented as normal. It's then represented as like cute. It's like, oh, look at him over there. He's the light eyes with the dark eyes concubine or mistress or whatever it is. But they can't get married. Oh, but isn't it nice that they like each other and that they're, oh yes, isn't that a quirky relationship? No, that should be a normal relationship. Why shouldn't it be? So there's all of that kind of stuff, which is like, I thought the book was going in one direction. But it just keeps going towards like, okay, Shallan is absolutely awful to everybody. She's terrible. If she was a slave owner, she would be the worst kind of slave owner. But then she's being presented as a hero and stuff like that. And at the end, she has to be brought low. She has to be shown that everything that she's done so far is awful. But in the end, the person that she's awful to is now up at her political situation too. It's sort of like, oh, so it's fine. Because in the end, you become a light eye. So everything that I do to all these other dark eyes, all the people who I've left destitute, all the people who I've left dead, all the other people who've just been waylaid by my insensitivity, that's fine because they're not around at the end of the book. The other thing, which is really politically problematic in a similar way, is there's this race of people called the Parshmen, and the Parshmen are the slaves. They've got brown skin, literally, like brown skin with marble, like reddish brown skin. Not, but they're not meant to be exactly human, but kind of like, they wouldn't be like elves because they're not too magical, but then they are magical, but they're kind of like, are they evil elves or they're not evil elves? And in the first book, it's like, oh, the Parshmen, they're actually going to turn out to be the void bringers. And it's all these slaves that we're taking advantage of. We need to free the slaves. We need to get rid of the slaves because actually they're really dangerous. And I was thinking, oh, by the end of this book, the Parshmen's slaves are not going to be evil. It's just going to be, people thought they're going to be evil, and it turns out actually they can just be freed, and they're not going to be evil, and they can be freed, and they can just be part of the world, or they can go over and set up a new country over there. And there's these other people called the Parshendi, who look like the Parshmen, but like a kind of like a related race. They're not slaves, they're the bad guys, you know, they're the people who were killing. But like, you have to have stormtroopers without human faces to be able to kill loads of them without feeling bad about it. Or you have to have orcs instead of humans to kill, because you can't just have battles between humans, because humans can be good too, right? Yeah, but no, orcs can't be. So these Parshmen are kind of like orcs, kind of like elves, but kind of like, you know, faceless other that we're okay killing lots of. And at one point in this book, one of the characters is like, well, they're not putting up a fight, I'm just killing them, and it's not good anymore, because it used to be when they fought back, I could think of them as the enemy, but now I just think of them as cannon fodder for us all just to mow down with our shard blades. And it's like, oh, well, that's a little bit interesting. You know, and I thought, oh, it will turn out that Parshendi and the Parshmen aren't actually evil, it's all a big misunderstanding, and what we're all going to do is going to be like, yeah, the Parshmen at the end, and the Parshendi and the humans are going to get together and actually fight the evil force, fight the void bringer that comes in. But then it turns out that the racism is actually justified. The fear of the other turns out to be totally justified and real. It turns out that the Parshmen really are that dangerous, and the Parshendi aren't just sort of like a misunderstood evil, or a misunderstood enemy that they're killing a lot of, and it turns out that actually they're not too bad of an enemy, because in the first book, a lot of the fighting between them is like, we want these aliens come out of these planes things which have gems inside, these gem hearts that they need to get. It's like currency and magic all in one inside these things. It was like, there's a gem heart, let's go, and the Parshendi try and come and capture that part of the plane, and get the gem heart, and then the humans come and try and get the gem heart, and the humans are fighting over themselves, between themselves, to get the gem heart and the Parshendi. It's like, the Parshendi didn't even feel like a proper enemy. It was like, yeah, the Parshendi said that they murdered the king, but this whole pact of revenge, it doesn't really mean anything. It was like pointless revenge. And then in this book, it turns out, no, actually what they were doing is the right thing. The Parshmen are evil, the Parshendi are evil, and not just bad, but like even worse than we thought. And I was like, that is weird. It's like Americans coming over, Europeans coming over to America, finding the Native Americans and going, well, these people, they're a bit shifty, aren't they? They're not Christians. Maybe we should turn them all into Christians. Okay, let's make them all into Christians. And in the end, it's sort of like, oh, it turns out all the Native Americans, it's not that they're just not Christians, it's they're actually demons. Okay, let's kill all of them. Okay, let's go. And you're like, is that the message politically? Is this where we're going? Now, maybe it is one of those things that maybe it's going to be a bit more complex than that. And maybe it's going to feel like really a lot less disturbing, because the language, if people are actually talking about misogyny and sexism in that language, which has evolved to talk about these issues in a deeper way than just, you know, I don't want to use racial terms, but you know, when language develops alongside the continuing progression of social norms and outlooks in that way, it feels like there should be more progress with the characters in the book away from kind of like manifest destiny means we will take this and we are white people and all these brown people and people with funny eyes and these people over here with different color skin, we will deal with them and they don't matter so much as us, they're we that matter. And so a mix of modern language based in the Enlightenment and technology and kind of modern political sensibilities, yet alongside the characteristics from a bit too far back in the day, let me put it that way. So those are all the things I don't like about the book. Weirdly enough, I really enjoyed it, though, because a lot of these things, it's like I can still, like, even if an author is politically not where I am or politically insensitive in ways, I'm like, well, how much is this as characters and how much further is this author going to take the characters, you know? Are the characters being presented in this way it, with the author's eyes open or with the author's eyes closed? And it's a tricky thing. It's a tricky thing, certainly with this book. I think there are some books which are a lot clearer about that, that people have a reaction against. For example, R. Scott Bakker with his Prince of Nothing series. There is a lot of presentation of sexism and misogyny and rape and all of these other kind of things in that book, but it's never shown as something good. You know, the imperialistic nature of other people is always shown as something bad. It depicts bad actions but always sides with good. It depicts bad actions but always presents those bad actions as this character is literally the worst person in the world and he's doing these things. They might seem cool, but just so you know, this person is the worst person in the world that you're reading about now. Okay, that's good. Just so we know that the hero over here is weaker, but his heart's in the right place. He still makes mistakes, but he's actually progressing towards something better. You know, that's the person that we're meant to be rooting for, the good person over there. Okay. And even though, like I say, the bad stuff in there is very bad, it's a lot worse than this, it's a lot darker, this book feels a lot more problematic because you're going, okay, this person over here is doing some really bad stuff, but they're actually the hero that you're meant to like. And this person over here has got these problems, okay, and in the end we're just going to, like, fix them magically and then he doesn't have to worry about those problems anymore. And you're like, not really, you know. It's, ambiguity is good, but sometimes politically problematic. Let me let's finish up. I think I've got through all of my notes. The reading of the book by the audiobook was very good. Let me just look up the people who read it. Michael Kramer and Kate Redding, who I've listened to those guys many times before, or guys in a gender neutral guys kind of way. Michael Kramer, I can't remember the other books he's done. Kate Redding, she did the Paladin of Souls and the what was that other one? So other fantasy books. So I know her from other fantasy books, did a pretty good job of reading. And it's one of those things that you just go, well, she did very well, but sometimes she became, because Michael Kramer, he did lots of different, all the male character point of views, and there's more of them. And Kate Redding just did Shallan's point of view, or maybe some others as well. I think there's a few other female characters that she did point of view things. So she kind of became Shallan in my head, which is annoying because I don't want one character to become like one audiobook narrator to be that much associated with a character I don't like. Yeah, that was very good. 48 hours took a long time to get through, pretty good. Oh, let's go over again to goodreads.com. And I'm going to give this book 3 stars. It's a little bit of a step down from the 3.5 stars that I gave the first book, but 3 stars is still above average, still worth reading. 2.5 stars, I would say, wouldn't be worth reading, but this is up there. Certainly, if you read and really enjoyed the first book, you will enjoy this one. At goodreads.com, check this out. Friends reviews set 4.75 average, which is very high. 4.75 average. Friends reviews is generally listeners to the SFBRP or people who I know via listeners. Everyone either rated it 5 stars or 4 stars. Check this out though. 4.76 ratings after 37,535 ratings in total on Goodreads.com. 4.76. Now this book has only been out a year. Or it came out this year, didn't it? I guess. First published January 1st, 2004, so exactly this year. So it's been out a year, which means it's got a lot of ratings. However, it's such a big, chunky book. People will only read this book if they really liked the first book. Like, they look at that first book and they're like, oh, 1,000 pages. And if you get through 1,000 pages and go, do you want another 1,000 pages of exactly the same thing? Only the people who really, really, really like that first book are going to be like, yeah, I'll have another 1,000 pages, you know, and they'll read it straight away. So it's going to be very highly rated. And then after about a year, once it's still highly rated after a year, I'd be like, well, I mostly enjoyed that first book. I'll see it. And I read it again. I'm like, oh, I kind of mostly enjoyed this second book too. And so I'd rate it, you know, 3 stars, but it means that later books in the series always skew high ratings, because if people are sticking around after thousands of books, it's going to be high ratings. So yeah, pretty good there. I don't think I've got anything else to say about this. I mean, I wish I'd have talked more about the stuff that I liked about it, but generally what I liked about it is the epicness. What I liked about it is the character, you know, are the main characters and what they're doing and what they're going through, and the world and the magic and the conspiracies and all of the, you know, plot subtleties, which aren't based around Shallon just discarding people. It's all pretty good, except the things that I mentioned. But like I say, if all these bad things were in a book 200 pages long, it would have been a really bad book. But they're all kind of spread out. They're diluted by the epicness. The shit is diluted in the epicness of a 1,088-page novel. I will leave my review there. 3 stars for this book, and probably won't go on to the next one because, oh yeah, I was going to say that. Kaladin's story kind of finished at the end of the last story, or some of the main characters were like, they had a really strong story in the first book, and then here they were kind of in a holding pattern, and at the end all of the characters seemed to come together into kind of like a natural stopping point. And I was like, all of these characters have achieved what they wanted to achieve. They've all done what they set out to do. And Shallon in the first book, she was in a holding pattern in that first book, and now in this book she really accelerated through. She's achieved what she wanted, and I feel like what's happened is that it's got to a natural stopping point. In the first book, it was a natural stopping point for two of the characters, or for some of the main characters, but not for Shallon. And this is a natural stopping point for all of the characters. And I'm thinking, that's it. Where is there to go? There's meant to be another 8 books in this series. It's obviously going to pick up on some of the other minor characters that we got here. But I really hope we don't spend any more time with these main characters, because now they're all too powerful. They're all kings and princes and powerful people, and they're the new Knights Radiant and all this other stuff. So you're just like, well, where have they got to go from here? Are they just going to fight bigger and bigger magic enemies or not? Or are we going to get back down to a human level and read more human stories from human level people? And I really hope that happens in the next book. Because if it's treading more ground with these characters, not interested at all. And maybe Shallon would have finally have had sex with someone. Or any of the characters would finally have had sex with anybody else. It would be actually really a bit more interesting if that kind of thing, if the relationships actually progressed to adult relationships. Which an adult relationship isn't just sitting next to each other reading novels. That's not really what I'm looking for in a passionate adult relationship. But I guess these are kids' books, so it doesn't really matter. Right, that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening. You can catch me on Goodreads, become my friend there, chat about this book and others on the Goodreads SFBRP listener group, which is a good way to chat with other people who like this podcast and might have opinions about this episode and others. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge there. You can email me. Luke@juggler.net is the best way to get in contact with me. If you want a response, I do respond to every email. And you can check out sfbip.com. Check out the episode list. If you're going to recommend a book or you want to see what books I've read, a lot of these early episodes don't make it into the RSS feed, into the iTunes feed and other things, because the feed, once you get over 200 episodes, or over 100 episodes, these feed readers don't work properly, the feeds don't work properly, iTunes doesn't list episodes going back all the way, maybe iTunes does, but other websites and services don't, so always check out the SFBRP episodes list page on sfbrp.com to check out all of the books and to and find the blog posts and the files to download direct from there. So check that out. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.